Hi, Dave Emery here. Side one, for the record, program number 817. Can you put lipstick on a Nazi? Part two, update on Ukraine. This is being recorded on October 30th of the year 2014. This past week, Ukraine had its parliamentary elections, and the media have been full of hosannas about how the results showed that democratic and, quote, moderate, unquote, interests were prevailing in Ukraine because the far-right parties were marginalized, or so we were told. And there has been much of the narcissistic and self-congratulatory and self-referential patting on the back by various sources. The New York Times, for example, called this a triumph of democracy, etc., etc., etc. And what we're going to be doing in this program is taking a look at how this really is not the case. The thing that is, I guess, front and center here is the fact that the so-called centrist or respectable parties, such as the party of Petro Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, who that they got the largest single parliamentary bloc, followed by former Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk's People's Front or National Front. What we're going to be looking at in this program is the extent to which the so-called respectable and mainstream parties have, in fact, not only incorporated many of the most virulent of the Ukrainian fascists and the OUNB heirs, including people from the Azov Battalion and the founder of the Azov Battalion. We're going to be taking a look at how some of the policies that have been pursued by these so-called centrists have, in fact, been on the agenda of the OUNB heirs that have come to power in Ukraine after the coup that took place in February. There has been a small number of media sources that have noted that the mainstream media in this country and the West in general have avoided talking about the Nazis who are in the Ukrainian government. I would submit that at least part of that with regard to the U.S. is the fact that those same Nazi and fascist elements have been present in the American government as well. The GOP's Ethnic Heritage Council, featuring people from the OUNB in a very prominent way, have become a key element of the Republican Party, and they were very much present in the Reagan administration with Ekaterina Chumachenko, a top UCCA operative, having been deputy director of public liaison under Ronald Reagan. And then she married Viktor Yushchenko, became first lady of Ukraine, and Viktor Yushchenko essentially implemented an Orwellian Ministry of Truth type government and completely rewrote the World War II history of Ukraine in a manner that was very kind to the OUNB fascists, whose heirs and whose continuing elements, such as Roman Sivarych, have basically carried on dutifully in Ukraine today. We're going to begin by taking a look at an article from the New York Times. This is from the New York Times of October 25th of the year 2014. It's by Neil McFarquhar, and capital M-A-C, capital F-A-R-Q-U-H-A-R. Putin lashes out at U.S. for backing, quote, neo-fascists, unquote, and, quote, Islamic radicals, unquote. And as one might well expect, this article has the tone that, well, Putin is nuts. And isn't it wild and outrageous that he is saying these things? And the fact of the matter is that, as can be readily verified, Putin is essentially accurate. Not only have we been backing Nazi elements in Ukraine throughout the Cold War, we did that in many places. And indeed, many of the former Soviet bloc countries had the World War II allied, Nazi allied elements projected back into them at the end of the war. And the new governments in many ways are reflecting that Nazi slash sympathy for Nazism and the Third Reich nostalgia that was present in those elements, such as the ABN and the Hungarian Arrow Cross, Romanian Iron Guard, the Croatian Ustashi, the OUNB, the Bulgarian National Front, and others. It's quite remarkable how things are proceeding in this country. Not only are our media behaving in an Orwellian and a deeply profoundly censored fashion, but the treatment of Russia and Russians is as bad, maybe even in some ways worse than during the Cold War. If Vladimir Putin and Sergei Lazarov, the Soviet foreign minister, said that 2 + 2 = 4, the mainstream media in this country would say that President Putin and Foreign Minister Lazarov repeated their claim that 2 + 2 = 4. Soviet media or Russian media have been full of this contention in recent months, and it has become a staple of Russian mathematical propaganda. I mean, things are that bad. Again, from the New York Times of October 25th of 2014, article by Neil McFarquhar. Putin lashes out at the U.S. for backing, quote, neo-fascists, unquote, and Islamic radicals, unquote. It reads in part, President Vladimir V. Putin of Russia on Friday unleashed perhaps his strongest diatribe against the U.S. yet, using an international meeting of Russian experts to sell Russia's view that American meddling has sparked most of the world's recent crises, including those in Ukraine and the Middle East. Instead of supporting democracy and sovereign states, Mr. Putin said during a 3-hour appearance at the conference, the U.S. supports, quote, dubious, unquote, groups ranging from open neo-fascists to Islamic radicals, unquote. Why do they support such people, he asked the annual gathering known as the Valdai Club, V-A-L-D-A-I, which met this year in the southern resort town of Sochi. They do this because they decide to use them as instruments along the way in achieving their goals, but then burn their fingers and recoil, unquote. Just skipping down. Mr. Putin, however, specifically denied trying to restore the Russian Empire. He argued that Russia was compelled to intervene in Ukraine because that country was in the midst of a civilized dialogue, unquote, over its political future when the West staged a coup to oust the president last February, pushing the country into chaos and civil war. We did not start this, he said. Statements that Russia is trying to reinstate some sort of empire, that it is encroaching on the sovereignty of its neighbors, are groundless, unquote. Well, again, the Times and other media voices in this country have treated that as just, you know, completely outrageous, outlandish, what have you. The fact of the matter is that we have been backing Nazi elements in the Ukraine and in other places, and as we looked at in the For the Record series about what I call the Muslim Brotherhood Spring or the Arab Spring, For the Record 733 through 739, we actively promoted the Muslim Brotherhood in countries in the Middle East. Of course, the Muslim Brotherhood, as seen in so many programs, including For the Record 343, For the Record 445, 514, and others, is an Islamic fascist organization allied with the Axis in World War II, and then after the war finding support from Western elements of Western intelligence, including the CIA, which saw them as an ideal or certainly a useful anti-communist cadre in the Muslim and Third Worlds. The ghosts of, not the ghosts, but the fallout from that are very much present today, and indeed in the person of Michael Bocirku, B-O-C-I-U-R-K-I-W, the head of the OSCE's special study mission in Ukraine. We find someone allied on the one hand with the OUND fascists that were projected into power by the coup earlier this year, and also elements of the Muslim Brotherhood from Malaysia. I talk about that at considerable length in For the Record 803 and in number 804. Robert Perry in Consortium News, or of Consortium News, posted an article the same day, that's October 25th of 2014, in which he accurately summarized the attitude that is being promulgated in the U.S. and elsewhere about Putin. It's called Treating Putin Like a Lunatic, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. Of course, all the, quote, smart people, unquote, of official Washington know how to react to such statements from Putin with a snicker and a roll of the eyes. After all, they've been reading the narratives of these crises as fictionalized by the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. Rationality and realism seem to have lost any place in the workings of the mainstream U.S. news media. Indeed. A very interesting, just a tiny little tidbit caught my eye. Back on September 9th of 2014, the New York Times carried an article by Carlotta Gall, G-A-L-L, Ukraine town bears scars of Russian offensive that turned tide in conflict, and interviewing a Ukrainian militiaman from one of the fascist volunteer battalions, we find, skipping down, the Russian army is very good, unquote, said a soldier in one of Ukraine's volunteer battalions farther south, who only gave his nickname Panzer, capital P-A-N-Z-E-R. Well, Panzer, of course, is the German word for tank. It also literally translates as Panther. German tanks in World War II were called Panzerkampfwagen Mark, whatever. The Panther tank was the Mark V. The famed Tiger tank was Panzerkampfwagen Mark VI, and so forth. And the fact that this fellow was using his nickname Panzer is only too revealing. Of course, the Times does not go into that. Now, again, by way of chronicling the putting of lipstick on the Nazi, of course, that is, I'm corrupting the old query that, quote, can you put, if you put lipstick on a pig at the end of the day, it is still a pig. And what the U.S. and others have been doing is putting lipstick on the Nazi and saying, well, this isn't a Nazi, it's whatever. And again, the hosannas following the recent Ukrainian elections hailed the fact that the far-right parties such as Svoboda and others didn't do as well, and that the, quote, democratic, unquote, quote, moderate, unquote, pro-Euro, pro-Western parties such as Poroshenko's party and Arseniy Yatsenyuk's People's Front or National Front, those are the parties that polled first and second, respectively. This was hailed as something of a triumph of moderation, democracy, blah, 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 blah. In fact, as we are going to see, not only have parties such as Poroshenko's and Yatsenyuk's incorporated some of the worst of the OUND-era fascists, but they also have been embracing some of the same points of view and policies. The following is from Interfax Ukraine of September 25th of 2014. OUN-UPA veterans could be given combatant status, the Poroshenko, unquote. It talks about Petro Poroshenko speaking very favorably of awarding benefits to the OUN-UPA fighters from World War II. They're also, in addition to UPA, you will see them called UIA. That is the Ukrainian insurgent army. And what we are going to look at here is, again, the putting of a lipstick on a Nazi, in the sense that policies that are simply Nazi policies are being hailed as okay, or at least the people putting them forward have been hailed as okay. Again, from Interfax Ukraine, OUN-UPA veterans could be given combatant status, Poroshenko reads in part. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko said it is worth considering assigning the status of combatant to veterans of the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, or Ukrainian Insurgent Army, OUN-UPA. Quote, "This is a very important issue and one that was raised in a very timely manner. Previously, this issue split the country and was not on the agenda. Now is the right time," he told the press conference in Kiev on Thursday. The president also added that he sees OUN-UPA fighters as examples of heroism. Well, the OUN-UPA, or UIA, as we have seen, basically help the staff not only Waffen-SS formations, but Einsatzgruppe units, and they performed the ethnic cleansing in World War II Nazi-occupied Ukraine, killing thousands of Poles, Jews, and others. So when Poroshenko is speaking favorably of giving them the veterans benefits, he's basically speaking favorably of awarding benefits, veterans benefits, to people who are outright murderers, war criminals, and staffing SS units as well. The motion or the drive to give them veterans benefits was actually turned down by the parliament, the Ukrainian parliament. It was deemed apparently just a little bit too naked and bad from a PR standpoint. That did not sit well with a lot of the Ukrainian forces. The following is an AP story from Yahoo News of October 14th of 2014. It's by Peter Leonard of the AP. Ukraine's parliament in Kiev, and it reads in part as follows. Clashes broke out Tuesday between demonstrators and police in front of Ukraine's parliament in Kiev as deputies inside reportedly voted down proposals to recognize a contentious World War II-era Ukrainian partisan group as national heroes. Thousands of Svoboda Nationalist Party supporters rallied earlier in the capital in celebration of the Ukrainian insurgent army, whose struggle for independence for Ukraine was tainted by its collaboration with the Nazis. Later, masked men attacked and threw smoke grenades on lines of police outside parliament as lawmakers met inside. The Svoboda Party, of course, not only one of the OUNB air parties that had a number that controlled a number of ministries in the provisional government. The Svoboda Party also has continued to wield influence within the Ukrainian government. We're going to talk more about that later. Note here again how Svoboda and President Poroshenko are basically marching in lockstep on this particular issue, or perhaps goose step would be a better word. Robert Perry, again, writing in Consortium News, has the following from October 15th of 2014. Ukraine's neo-Nazis demand respect. And this reads in part as follows. For months, the New York Times and other major U.S. news outlets have insisted that it's just Russian propaganda to say that a significant neo-Nazi presence exists inside Ukraine. But thousands of these non-existent, unquote, neo-Nazis battled police on Tuesday outside the parliament building in Kiev, demanding recognition of their Hitler-collaborating forebears. The parliament, aware of the obvious public relations fiasco that would follow if it bowed to far-right demands to honor members of the Nazi-affiliated Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or URA, defeated the proposal. That touched off riots by an estimated 8,000 protesters led by Ukraine's right-wing Svoboda Party and the right sector. Historians blame the URA and other Ukrainian fascist forces for the extermination of thousands of Poles and Jews during World War II, as these right-wing Ukrainian paramilitaries sided with the German Nazis in their fight against the Soviet Union's Red Army. Svoboda and the right sector have elevated URA leader Stefan Bandera to the level of a Ukrainian national hero. Viktor Yushchenko, who came to power during the Orange Revolution and who had the former Ekaterina Shumachenko, Ronald Reagan's deputy director of public liaison, and a key OUNB operative of the from the UCCA, the Ukrainian Congress Committee of America. She married Viktor Yushchenko and became First Lady of the Ukraine. And as we have seen, the Yushchenko regime basically rewrote the history of Ukraine in a pro-OUND fashion. Viktor Yushchenko, before leaving office, named both Stefan Bandera and the leader of the Ukrainian Partisan Army or Ukrainian Insurgent Army, a guy named Roman Shukievich, as heroes of the Ukraine. As we looked at in For the Record 800, Petro Poroshenko basically reconstituted the Yushchenko government. And so, in a sense, it's sort of meet the new bosses, same as the old bosses. And one should be aware of that. So, again, Viktor Yushchenko did, in fact, name not only Bandera, but the head of the OUN-UPA as heroes of the Ukraine, as we have looked at in, among other shows, For the Record 779. A street in the Lvov district in Ukraine, in the western Ukraine, was named in honor, renamed in honor of the Noctegal Battalion, or the Einsatzgruppe Noctegal. That was the UPA formation that liquidated the Jewish and Polish populations of Lvov. It's like naming a street Hitler Avenue. One of the things that we have looked at in connection with the Yushchenko government and also in connection with Petro Poroshenko is the fact that a guy named Roman Zvarych, S-V-A-R-Y-C-H, was the justice minister under Viktor Yushchenko. He also was justice minister under both Tymoshenko governments, and he is a key advisor to Petro Poroshenko. Roman Zvarych was the personal secretary in the early 1980s of a guy named Yaroslav Stetsko. Stetsko was the wartime president of the wartime head of state of Nazi-occupied Ukraine, and both praised and implemented Nazi ethnic cleansing policies with regard to Jews, Poles, and others, as well as Russians, in Ukraine during World War II. He became head of the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations and the OUND after the death of Stefan Bandera in 1959. And in the early 1980s, his personal secretary was Roman Zvarych, who then, again, Stetsko's widow, Slava Stetsko, formed the Ukrainian National Congress. He held the equivalent of attorney general post under Yushchenko, both Tymoshenko governments, and is now an advisor to Petro Poroshenko. And the implications of having an OUND sympathetic justice minister, again, the equivalent of attorney general, is going to be viewed in the story that we are about to go into. The interim government that I alluded to earlier, the provisional government that came to power following the Maidan coup earlier this year, had a number of posts and ministries controlled by Svoboda and the Pravi Sector, which were two of the OUNB air organizations that were front and center in the fighting at the Maidan. One of the ministries that was controlled by Svoboda was the Justice Ministry, where a guy named Oleh Makhnitsky, M-A-K-H-N-I-T-S-K-Y, from Svoboda became Minister of Justice. He is now an advisor to the supposedly respectable, unquote, pro-Western, unquote, democratic Petro Poroshenko. What we're going to look at here, I guess, is sort of the administration of justice, Poroshenko style, and OUNB style as well. Reuters.com had an article on October 10th of the year 2014. Special report, flaws found in Ukraine's probe of Maidan massacre. It's by Steve Steklow, S-T-E-C-K-L-O-W, and Oleksandr Akimenko, O-L-E-K-S-A-N-D-R, last name capital A-K-Y-M-E-N-K-O. And what we're going to be focusing on primarily in this story is the, quote, investigation, unquote, of the shootings and deaths that took place this past winter in Ukraine in the Maidan. A number of demonstrators were shot, some of them fatally, some just wounded, and a bunch of policemen were shot as well. And there has been a, quote, investigation, unquote, which has to say the very, which has been, to say the very least, badly compromised. Evidence has been destroyed. The prosecutors and investigative personnel have made very provocative statements, already asserting the guilt of those whom they are investigating in contravention of European law. And again, evidence has been either misplaced or destroyed. And perhaps one of the most bitterly amusing aspects of this concerns the fact that a fellow who was a member of an elite unit within the Yanukovych security forces, basically a fellow named Sadovnik, Dmytro Sadovnik, S-A-D-O-V-N-Y-K, was, quote, photographed, unquote, holding a rifle and has been accused by the Makhnitsky slash Svoboda-dominated Justice Ministry in Ukraine of having led the shooters in Ukraine. The problem, as we will see, is that the photograph showing Mr. Sadovnik holding a rifle, presumably prior to using that to help shoot innocent demonstrators, this photograph is obviously doctored because Sadovnik lost one of his hands 6 years ago to a grenade in a training accident. The picture very clearly shows him holding a rifle with both hands, with the fingers very obviously displayed. And since he only has one hand, I guess this is a case of one hand not washing the other. And I guess you could say this is OUNB slash Svoboda justice made manifest. And we're going to go into this at greater length and in greater detail in Side 2. This concludes Side 1, for the record, program number 817. Can You Put Lipstick on a Nazi? Part 2, Update on Ukraine, being recorded on October 30th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao. Hi, Dave Emery here. Side 2, for the record, program number 817. Can You Put Lipstick on a Nazi? Part 2. This is being recorded on October 30th of the year 2014. We're going to be picking up right where we left off in Side 1, taking a look at what happens when you allow people like Svoboda, the OUNB heirs, and the fascists of that ilk to administer, quote, justice, unquote. One of the things that we have looked at in past programs concerns the fact that the Azov Battalion, one of the Nazi fighting formations in Ukraine, featuring a large number of foreign fighters, has featured, among other things, the Swedish military veterans, some of them with sniper training, and some of those veterans have stated that they were present in the Euromaidan, in the square where the demonstrations were taking place, to use their sniping skills. It was never confirmed exactly against whom they were going to be using those sniping skills. It certainly raises an interesting question. Was it they who fired the first shot, thereby precipitating the gunplay in the Maidan demonstrations? Did they commit provocations? Was it those people who fired into the crowd and killed some of the demonstrators as well as policemen? Certainly that is something that needs to be investigated, but it is not going to be investigated. Again, Reuters.com, October 10th, 2014. Special report: flaws found in Ukraine's probe of Maidan massacre by Steve Steklo, S-T-E-C-K-L-O-W, and Oleksandr Akimenko, O-L-E-K-S-A-N-D-R, A-K-Y-M-E-N-K-O. Now note, in this investigation, evidence is being destroyed. The investigators have made public statements about the obvious guilt of those whom they are investigating in direct contravention of European legal procedure and regulations. And in addition, there has been some very obvious forging of evidence in which a guy named Dmytro D-M-Y-T-R-O Sadovnik, S-A-D-O-V-N-Y-K, an officer with the Berkut, capital B-E-R-K-U-T, riot police under Yanukovych, has been accused of firing into the crowd and committing crimes against the Maidan demonstrators. And a photograph was produced showing him holding a rifle with two hands, the fingers very obviously showing on both hands, as I mentioned in side one. Mr. Sadovnik lost one of his hands to a grenade in a training accident 6 years ago. He only has one hand. So obviously this picture has been doctored. Remember, as you hear this, that when this investigation was taking place, the head of the Justice Ministry was Oleg Makhnitsky from Svoboda. By the way, I'm probably mispronouncing many of these Ukrainian names. And again, remember that under Yushchenko and both Tymoshenko governments, Roman Zvorich, the personal secretary of Yaroslav Stetsko, was the Minister of Justice, the same post that Makhnitsky held earlier this year. And Zvorich is now an advisor to Petro Poroshenko, and he was a former three-time justice minister. That's the equivalent of attorney general. To this Reuters.com story. For millions of Ukrainians, it was a crime against humanity. In February, more than 100 protesters were gunned down in the Maidan uprising that toppled the president, Viktor Yanukovych. The victims are now known as the Heavenly Hundred, unquote. In April, prosecutors arrested three suspects, members of an elite unit within the Berkut riot police, Berkut capital, B-E-R-K as in kangaroo, U-T as in Thomas. Continuing. Senior among them was Dmytro Sadovnik, 38, a decorated commander who was accused of ordering his men to fire on the crowds on the morning of February 20th. The three stand accused of massacring 39 unarmed protesters. On September 19th, the case took a turn when a judge released Sadovnik into house arrest, and 2 weeks later, he went missing, skipping down. In a country where justice often isn't blind, there is another possibility. This referring to allegations that he fled to avoid retribution for his alleged crimes. Beginning again. In a country where justice often isn't blind, there's another possibility. Sadovnik was being framed and saw flight as his best option. In court last month, he called the case against him a political lynching, unquote. In the days before he vanished, his wife and his lawyer say Sadovnik and his family received death threats. A Reuters examination of Ukraine's probes into the Maidan shootings, based on interviews with prosecutors, defense attorneys, protesters, police officers, and legal experts has uncovered serious flaws in the case against Sadovnik and the other two Berkut officers. Among the evidence presented against Sadovnik was a photograph. Prosecutors say it shows him near Kiev's Independence Square on February 20th, wearing a mask and holding a rifle with two hands, his fingers clearly visible. The problem, Sadovnik doesn't have two hands. His right hand, his wife told Reuters, was blown off by a grenade in a training accident 6 years ago. As prosecutors introduced the image at a hearing in April, said Yulia Sadovnik, her husband removed a glove and displayed his stump to the courtroom. He can't really shoot, said Serhiy Vilkov, V-I-L-K-O-V, Sadovnik's lawyer. To blame him for the crime is a political game, unquote. The probes into the killings have been hindered by missing evidence. Many guns allegedly used to shoot protesters have vanished. Many of the bullets fired were taken home as souvenirs. Barricades, bullet-pierced trees, and other items of forensic evidence were removed, lawyers say. So obviously, there are some questions here about just what exactly is going on when you are destroying evidence. Obviously, it makes it makes a determination of fact more than a little problematic. I've noticed that there's no mention in this article of the fact that some foreign-born snipers, including one from Sweden, who were serving in the Nazi Azov battalion, said that they were present in Maidan to serve as snipers. On whose behalf and against whom was not stated, but it certainly raises the interesting question about whether perhaps they were doing some of the shooting into the crowd as well in order to precipitate the bloodbath. Skipping down in this article. The two prosecutors and the government minister who have led the Maidan shooting probes all played roles in supporting the uprising itself. One of these officials told Reuters that the investigators gathering the evidence are completely independent. Another gap in the prosecution. To date, no one has been apprehended in the shooting of policemen. According to Ukraine's Ministry of Interior Affairs, between February 18th and 20th, 189 police officers suffered gunshot wounds, 13 died. In addition, the former acting attorney general who oversaw the arrests of the three Berkut officers declared on television that they, quote, have already been shown to be guilty, unquote. That statement, said legal experts, could prejudice the cases. Ukraine is a party to the European Convention on Human Rights, which states that criminal defendants are presumed innocent until proven guilty. Quote, a public statement by a prosecutor that directly challenges that presumption is a denial of due process, says Richard Harvey, a British barrister who specializes in international criminal law. Even some of the bereaved families question the fairness of the proceedings. Sergei Bondarchuk, B-O-N-D-A-R-C-H-U-K, a physics teacher, died of a gunshot wound to the back on the morning of February 20th. His son, Volodymyr Bondarchuk, said the killing is one of 39 in which Sadovnik and his two colleagues are suspected. Volodymyr said that based on his own inquiries, he doubts the three were responsible for his father's death. Quote, they are trying to close the case because their bosses and the community just want to have someone to punish, he said, again quoting, the investigation does not have enough evidence to prove the guilt of these three people, unquote, and skipping down still further. Oleg, O-L-E-H, Makhnitsky, M-A-K-H-N-I-T-S-K-Y, was Ukraine's acting general prosecutor until June. In an interview, Reuters asked him about the purported photograph of a two-handed Sadovnik, which was cited at a hearing in April, skipping down again. Makhnitsky, now an advisor to President Petro Poroshenko, said he was a leader of a lawyer's group that provided legal assistance to anti-Yanukovych protesters during the Maidan demonstrations. He said politics played no role in the prosecution of the three Berkut officers. What is not mentioned here is the fact that Motnitsky, as we looked at in For the Record 779, among other programs, is a member of the Svoboda Party. He is now an advisor to President Petro Poroshenko. Again, Roman Zvorich, the personal secretary to Yaroslav Stetsko, head of OUNB, the head of the Anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations, formerly the Committee of Subjugated Nations when it was formed by Adolf Hitler in 1943. And again, Yaroslav Stetsko, the head of state of the Nazi-occupied Ukraine government in World War II. His personal secretary was Roman Zvorich, also an advisor to Poroshenko, and the fellow who was the justice minister under Viktor Yushchenko and both Yulia Tymoshenko governments as well. So again, that's what you get when you put Svoboda people or OUNB heirs in as the head of the Justice Ministry. Again, that's the equivalent of Attorney General in the U.S. Note that Makhnitsky was serving, was one of a number of people who was providing legal assistance to the anti-Yanukovych protesters. Certainly does not appear to be a particularly objective observer or jurist under these circumstances. Another Reuters story, this from Newswire's Euronews of October 21st of 2014. War heroes and activists to shape new look Ukraine parliament. It's by Richard Balmforth, B-A-L-M-F-O-R-T-H, and Pavel Polityuk. That's P-A-V-E-L-P-O-L-I-T-Y-U-K. Now, what this article is talking about primarily is the fact that because of the civil war in the eastern part of the country, as well as the fact that Crimea basically is now back to being part of Russia, that in reaction to the anti-Russian and pro-OUNB stance of the forces that came to power in the Maidan coup, the fact that the civil war took place in the eastern part of the country and therefore voting in that part of the country has been seriously disrupted, in effect, with regard to the electoral results that we are seeing in Ukraine, we have witnessed a very real degree of ethnic cleansing, because a lot of the ethnic Russians and pro-Russian residents of Ukraine simply have not been able to vote. What isn't mentioned in this story is that scores of thousands, probably 100, maybe 200,000, have actually fled to Russia and are awaiting resettlement, according to mainstream sources in the U.S. So the Ukrainian parliamentary results in the election should be seen as tainted very strongly by ethnic cleansing, the civil war, and the anti-Russian actions and statements of the provisional government and the OUNB heirs that have come to power in it. Skipping down in this article. The loss of Crimea and prevention of normal voting in the East, where violence persists despite a ceasefire between Ukrainian forces and the rebels, will mean the number of seats occupied in the new parliament will shrink to 424, according to central election authorities. The others, and Savchenko's, if as expected she is elected, will remain vacant. Commentators expect a strong pro-Europe majority to emerge. Quote, at least half of parliament at the very least will be changed now. There will be utterly different party structures in parliament, said Volodymyr Fazenko, F-E-S-E-N-K-O, of the PENTA, P-E-N-T-A, think tank. The absolute majority will be those political forces linked to European integration and the Maidan. And again, this is after a civil war and some ethnic cleansing has taken place. And so, again, the results there that have been touted in the West, again, at least on the subject of Ukraine, the insufferable New York Times, which is in Warren Commission mode, a Warren report, now they published the Warren report vis-a-vis Ukraine, The election results should be seen in light of the fact that there has been some very real and effective ethnic cleansing of Russian-speaking and pro-Russian minority located primarily in the eastern part of the Ukraine. And it turns out that when the results came in, as expected, Petro Poroshenko's party won a majority. Number two was the National Front, or Popular Front, of Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and we're going to talk more about him. Svoboda did, in fact, win seats in the parliament. So, by the way, did the Radical Party of Oleh Lyashkov, L-Y-A-S-H-K-O-V, who helped to form some of the Nazi militias. And although Pravi Sektor didn't win seats in parliament as a party, the head of Pravi Sektor, Dmytro Yarosh, who was the deputy defense minister in the provisional government, did win a seat in parliament. The following is from Haaretz, an Israeli paper of October 27th of 2014. It is by Andreas Stein, S-T-E-I-N, and Nicholas von Twickel, T-W-I-C-K-E-L. Poroshenko claims landslide victory for pro-Western parties in Ukraine election. And it reads in part, skipping down, an exit poll released after polls closed on Sunday said that the president's newly formed party, the Poroshenko bloc, stands to get 23%, followed by Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk's National Front with 21.3%, skipping down. Also in parliament, according to the poll, are the Nationalist Svoboda Party with 6.3% and the Radical Party of Populist Politician Oleh Lyashko. And skipping down again. However, exit polls talking about the fact that Right Sector did not win the requisite 5%. That's along with Svoboda, one of the OUNB era parties. However, exit polls predict that Right Sector leader Dmytro Yarosh won a direct seat in his native Dnepropetrovsk region, according to Sventoslav Olynyk, O-L-I-Y-N-Y-K, a deputy regional governor. So again, note that Pravi Sektor did indeed get seated in parliament. So too did the Radical Party of Oleh Lyashkov. The fact that the two largest parties were Petro Poroshenko's bloc and Arseniy Yatsenyuk's National Front, or People's Front, should be seen in light of the fact that, again, Roman Svarich, Yaroslav Stetsko's personal secretary, is an advisor to Poroshenko. So too is Oleg Magnitsky, the former justice minister, the equivalent of our attorney general. He is from Svoboda. And again, Poroshenko reconstituted the old Yushchenko team, so the team Yushchenko, so to speak. A thing that's very important to note as well is that Arseniy Yatsenyuk's National Front, or People's Front, again, hailed as one of the moderate pro-Western democratic blah, blah, blah parties, has in its ranks people from the Azov Battalion. And we're going to take a look at that right now. This is from the Vital German ForeignPolicy.com newsletter from October 24th of the year 2014. It's called Nationalist Upsurge. And it reads in part as follows, skipping down. It notes that the Petro Poroshenko bloc has had as its top candidate former boxer Vitali Klitschko, who has been systematically groomed by the CDU-affiliated Konrad Adenauer Foundation. So again, Vitali Klitschko is something of a German cat's paw in Ukraine. Now note the following, this dealing with some of the people who are in the, quote, moderate, unquote, government or party of Arseniy Yatsenyuk. Beyond the spectrum of overtly fascist parties, we find the People's Front, the party of Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who had been put in power by the West and is campaigning with well-known right-wing extremists. Tatiana Chernovov, capital T-E-T-I-A-N-A, capital C-H-O-R-N-O-V-O-L, the former press secretary of the fascist UNA UNSO organization, who in the meantime has joined the Azov Battalion, is the second candidate on the ballot of the People's Front. The People's Front has also established a military council, unquote, to profit from the country's nationalist war frenzy. The military council also includes Azov Battalion Commander Andrei Biletsky, capital B-I-L-E-T-S-K-Y. Biletsky once declared, quote, "The historic mission of our nation in this critical moment is to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade for their survival in a, quote, crusade against the Semite-led Untermenschen," unquote. His Azov Battalion had participated in the violent attacks on the Ukrainian parliament. These attacks began on October 14th, when the majority of the deputies rejected the motion for declaring October 14th an official holiday. The Ukrainian Insurgent Army, or UPA, which had also committed massacres on more than 90,000 Christian and Jewish Poles, was founded October 14th, 1942. So again, part of the military council of Arseniy Yatsenyuk's People's Front or National Front is Azov Battalion founder Andrei Biletsky, who again stated, quote, "The historic mission of our nation in this critical moment is to lead the white races of the world in a final crusade for their survival," unquote, in a, quote, crusade against the Semite-led Untermenschen, unquote. Well, hey, I mean, that sure sounds moderate to me. Doesn't that sound moderate to you? I have in the description to the program the rest of this GermanForeignPolicy.com article. GermanForeignPolicy.com feeds along the lower right-hand side of the front page of the SpitfireList.com website. And I would note several things here. First of all, Human Rights Watch has cited the Ukrainian government as using banned, internationally banned cluster munitions against its own citizens. It talks about the fact that Ukraine is on the verge of economic collapse. It remains to be seen how that and very possibly the continuation of the endemic corruption that has plagued Ukrainian governments since it broke away from the former Soviet Union. Remains to be seen how that will be received. It also talks about some blatant anti-Russian lies that were crafted by the former Polish foreign minister, Radoslaw Sikorski. What I thought we would do before I wrap this program up is to listen to a very short section for the record, program number 26, called The Sons of the Gestapo, recorded in 1995, to give people an idea of the long-standing, the historical depth and the scope of the OUNB Ukrainian fascist activities in this country, which helped to pave the way for the kind of propaganda we're seeing. We're going to take a look at an incident that happened in 1941. This, as reported in the book Sabotage by Michael Sayers and Albert E. Kahn. In turn, the information comes from an anti-fascist newsletter called The Hour that was published in the United States by sociologist Hannah Arendt, author Thomas Mann, and Albert Einstein, the famed physicist. This is from, for the record, number 26, recorded in December of 1995.
From the book Sabotage, subtitled The Secret War Against America, that was co-authored by Michael Sayers, S-A-Y-E-R-S, and Albert E. Kahn, K-A-H-N. That book is published in hardcover by Harper & Brothers Publishers, New York and London, copyrighted 1942. The book contains the following quote in its preface. It's a quote from a speech by Vice President Henry A. Wallace on May 8, 1942. It reads, "We may be sure that Hitler and Japan will cooperate to do the unexpected. In any event, the psychological and sabotage offensive in the United States and Latin America will be timed to coincide with or anticipate by a few weeks the height of the military offensive. We must be especially prepared to stifle the fifth columnists in the United States who will try to sabotage not merely our war material plants, but, even infinitely more important, our minds." And indeed, the strategy of tension, the deliberate propagation of terrorism in order to undermine the public's confidence in the government and to provoke anti-democratic measures on the part of the government is something we will be talking about later. This book, Sabotage, by Albert Kahn and Michael Sayers, begins with the following. In its first chapter, entitled The Ghosts That Walk Again, there is the following, entitled The Ghost of a Firebug. It was 9:15 p.m., March 16, 1941. The Cleveland-Pittsburgh Express was thundering across the snow-blanketed Pennsylvania countryside on the last lap of its 400-mile run. Rushing alongside the black streak of the Ohio River at a speed of 65 miles an hour, the train neared the little town of Baden, B-A-D-E-N. Periodically, the engineer poked his head from his window and quickly jerked it back into the cab. The night was bitter cold. The locomotive's great beam bored into clouds of falling snowflakes. Eerie and shrill, the engine whistle sounded across the white fields. Suddenly, without warning, the giant engine swayed violently and with a furious grinding roar, it leaped from the tracks and hurtled down the riverbank. Behind the locomotive, the passenger cars were catapulted one after another into the dark, icy water, twisting and turning and crumpling like toys. As the deafening cacophony of ripping metal subsided, there came a deep gasp of steam from the overturned engine as if it were breathing its last. Then could be heard the piercing, terrible screams of the injured. 5 persons were killed, 121 were injured. Pennsylvania Railroad officials said, quote, definitely caused by sabotage, unquote. The Interstate Commerce Commission reported the results of its investigation on May 8th. Malicious tampering with the track, unquote, had caused the wreck. At the Interstate Commerce Commission hearing, experts expressed the belief that the derailment plot was aimed at the 13-car Manhattan Limited, which had passed over the same tracks 18 minutes before the disaster occurred. A group of United States Army men were aboard the Manhattan Express, and the train carried 44 Soviet representatives, part of a delegation of engineers and diplomats who had arrived at San Pedro, California from Vladivostok on March 12th. Fascist Ukrainian saboteurs working for the Nazis were suspected of having caused the wreck. An anti-fascist newsletter published in New York City, The Hour, revealed that the Pittsburgh industrial area was infested with cells of a fascist Ukrainian terrorist organization operating under the intelligence service of the German War Office. Captain Leonid Klimenko, K-L-I-M-E-N-K-O, a fascist Ukrainian emissary from the German War Office, had arrived in the United States a short time before the train wreck and had held secret conferences with key fifth columnists working in the Pittsburgh area. At the time of the wreck, Klimenko was already on his way back to Berlin. The Hour urged federal authorities to investigate the Pittsburgh Friends of Captain Klimenko.
That again from For the Record program number 26, The Sons of the Gestapo, recorded in December of 1995. That by way of giving people an idea of some of the historical and political depth of the OUNB / Ukrainian fascist component in the U.S. That was one of the things that laid the groundwork not only for the incorporation of these people into U.S. intelligence and politics at the end of the war, but helped to generate the tremendous momentum that is distorting the view of events in Ukraine here in the United States. This concludes Side 2, For the Record, program number 817. Can You Put Lipstick on a Nazi? Part 2. Update on Ukraine. This has been recorded on October 30th of the year 2014. I'm Dave Emery. Ciao.